Welcome to Byline. I'm Rick Heldet. President Obama says he's looking for immigration reform to be completed this year and perhaps as soon as 6 months. He said this week that a deal should be attainable this year, but he wants it done even sooner. He says that politics and not technical issues are standing in the way. A group of senators, both Democrats and Republicans, has agreed on a framework for comprehensive immigration reform, including a path to citizenship for 11 million illegal immigrants already in the country. The president is promoting his own set of principles similar to those in the Senate plan. In the Republican-controlled House, another group of lawmakers is working on its own proposal. Well, the Louisville area is home to a community of immigrants, and here to talk about the legislation being shaped and what it might mean for that community is Edgardo Mancilla, Executive Director of the Americana Community Center. Mr. Mancilla is a native of Argentina and works extensively with immigrants, refugees, and low-income families. Mr. Mancilla, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. Also here is Kate Miller, Program Associate with the ACLU of Kentucky, which is keeping a close eye on immigration reform efforts. Welcome, Kate.
Thanks.
Well, I should say welcome back. Mr. Mancilla, of course, we've been down this road many times before. Previous efforts at immigration have been attempted. It appears that this is taking a more bipartisan tone, I think in part given the Hispanic vote from last year. Do you agree with the president that something can be done as soon as this year?
I hope so. I hope so. Immigration reform is something needed. It's well behind times. The problem that we are facing today is because we don't have a clear immigration law in the United States. And something has to be done. Seems to me that now we have the political need for both parties, so seems that the conditions are there.
Kate Miller, the president announced his a plan this week. Has he released any details? Many details about it?
He's released four major components of his proposal to strengthen border security, crack down on employers that hire undocumented workers, create an earned path to citizenship, and streamlining our legal immigration system.
Gerdo, how many immigrants do we have here in the Louisville area?
Around 100,000. Depends on the number that you can play around, but it's almost one person is born in another country every 7.5 residents. And I think that we got the dimension of international population in town yet. One every 7.5 residents is born in another country. So it's a lot.
Any estimate of how many undocumented folks we have here?
The estimate goes between 60 to 80,000 in metro area.
Well, the common thread here has been the path to citizenship and these various plans that have been floated. What else would you like to see?
A couple of things. In reality, it's more than a path to be permanent resident, because to become citizen, you have to wait 5 years after you become permanent resident, and you can choose or not to become citizen. So this is one element. The thing that concerns me, there are two pieces that concern me the most. One, that the whole project is based on enforce the security on the border. So what is the definition? How many people supposed to control that piece of the proposal? The other element is, in order to become permanent resident and mostly to become citizen, you have to pass a test that is in English. So is the federal government going to provide funding to have more English as a second language classes? How the people are going to learn English and how will be the situation so they can access to this English requirement? So these are pieces of what I concern. The other element is, or the third piece, is seems to me there is a disconnect between reality and fantasy. Mm-hmm. We have so many stereotypes about undocumented. We don't realize that most of the half of the undocumented have high education level, for example. So we are talking about a workforce that can make a huge impact, especially in states like Kentucky, that we have such a large elder population. How we are going to replace the top management and how we are going to replace the low skill elements. So I think there's a lot of talking and looking for solutions.
We definitely, I'd like to piggyback on what you said about Border Patrol. The ACLU definitely supports a fair and practical process for attaining citizenship. We definitely want a policy that respects privacy and other fundamental rights. And Border Patrol is something that both the Republicans and the Democrats have highlighted. And what I want to point out, what a lot of people don't know, is the government defines our border as a 100-mile strip that wraps around the entire external boundary of the United States. So most of our major cities fall within this border. And within this border, and actually two-thirds of American residents live within this border. And the ACLU actually refers to this border as a constitution-free zone or a constitution-light zone. You're subject to heightened surveillance, like drones are already in use. You're also subject to a diminished Fourth Amendment protection. Search and seizure is something that's not explicitly protected in that area. On top of that, Border Patrol is already the largest law enforcement agency within the federal government, 60,000 employees. To put that in perspective, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms is about 5,000 employees. So we want to make sure that everyone's rights are protected, Americans, immigrants, citizens, and we want to make sure that strengthening border security doesn't mean frivolously expanding border security.
I don't know if President Obama has addressed this, but in the Senate plan, there appears to be an element that would call for some sort of fine or back taxes for those who mm-hmm. are undocumented. And that would seem to be a problem for just about everyone.
Just imagine your own budget. You have to pay back taxes. This is another question. How is it going to be implemented? And how the dignity of the person is going to be respected in the whole process? Undocumented immigrants are not just one single person. Most of them have families. Most of them are married with USA citizens. Most of them have children. So how you can keep the family unit as a part of the process? And this is, again, I don't see it in any of the proposals.
Yeah, we want it to be reasonable. I mean, the problem has been that it's been a really unworkable system, and we certainly don't want to create another underclass moving forward. Undocumented individuals are very vulnerable to abusive employers, to abusive relationships. We have a client in Northern California, mm-hmm. that called the local police after she was violently attacked by her partner. She was undocumented and he was not. She was the one that was removed from the home in handcuffs. So we want to make sure that people feel safe in their homes and that we don't push people further into this underclass with unreasonable expectations.
And I believe the Senate plan calls for some sort of identification system as well. That I know the ACLU is very interested in that.
Yeah, we want to be careful that this isn't a thinly veiled attempt at a national ID. Especially with employer verification, we don't want employers working as immigration agents. And we don't want workers forced to share vulnerable private information with their employers that in turn put it into internet databases that by the government's own account are unworkable and not safe. We don't want to open people up to further identity fraud.
Edgardo, at the Americana Community Center, what's the reaction been this week to President Obama's revival of this proposal?
Most of the people coming to the center are refugees, so they are legal residents. Mm-hmm. This no impact their life. For the ones who we know for personal connections and coming to the center, it's a sense of hope. Say, well, finally, we have something on the table that we can talk about. It's a lot of unknown issues, but the sense is, okay, I think that I can be part officially of this society, because they are part of society. They are working. Mm-hmm. Some of them own houses. They are paying taxes, believe or not. So it's a lot of myths that the general public don't understand. There are myths. But the same, for example, one myth, workforce salaries. One, based on the study that was done in the 80s when was the other amnesty, and this is not amnesty, by the way, it's a totally different ballgame. But the study shows that the salaries went up, not down. That you have more people paying taxes, so the revenue is growing for everyone. And these are, again, information that we listen over and over and over and become, you know, a lie say many, many times become true. Well, let's try to look the real data and see, hey, we have a potential here for a better society.
We are in the very early stages of this, and of course we'll be watching as this legislation is shaped. And Kate Miller, I know that there's an event coming up in Frankfort you wanted to talk about.
Absolutely. New Kentuckians at the Capitol is scheduled for February 27th, and it's an opportunity for immigrants and allies all across the Commonwealth to come together, build relationships with legislators, with each other, and share information. Even though we have a small immigrant population in Kentucky, it has grown significantly in the past 10 years. And Kentucky is better, especially economically, because of it. So we want to make those investments, and we want to connect individuals with local government.
Kate Miller with the ACLU and Edgardo Mancilla, the Executive Director of the Americana Center in Louisville. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much.
This is Byline on WFPL. The Kentucky General Assembly resumes next week. Lawmakers held a week-long organizational session last month and will now get to work for the 30-day session. There have been a few interesting developments in the interim. And joining us to talk about those and set the scene for the 2013 General Assembly is Kentucky Public Radio's Kenny Colston, who joins us by phone from Frankfort. Hi, Kenny.
Hey, how's it going?
Fine. How are you?
I'm pretty good.
Well, the big news this week, I would have to be industrial hemp, as U.S. Senator Mitch McConnell has gotten behind the push to legalize hemp and make it a cash crop here in Kentucky.
There is clearly some hemp mentum, Rick, in the Capitol. I do have to say that. You know, Senator McConnell, you have Senator Paul. You also have three congressmen in Kentucky. It seems likely that the state Senate is going to pass the measure. It clearly has a lot going behind it at this point. It's going to be out in front. They're going to take it up the second week of the session in the state Senate. And so, you know, clearly James Comer has done his work on the Senate side with his fellow GOP colleagues. And, you know, of course, he also has Democrat John Yarmuth, who supports it. He's a congressman. So it's interesting. He's got it, I would probably say, halfway of where it needs to be, and now he's got to work on recruiting Democrats in the State House and I guess, soften some of the opposition that state police have.
Well, I've been in the news business and radio since about 1984, I guess, and it seems like every year there's been a push on to legalize hemp in Kentucky and bring it back as the big crop it was back during the war years. Gatewood Galbraith, of course, comes to mind, who had his gubernatorial campaign based on hemp. I remember one year, Woody Harrelson, the actor, came to Eastern Kentucky and planted some seeds, got himself arrested on purpose to draw attention to it. But this year, it seems to have more momentum than ever before.
Yeah, I think what you see is you have someone who is very popular. Agriculture Commissioner James Comer was a big vote getter in his election in 2011. The only Republican to actually win a seat during those statewide races. He's got the trust of the agriculture community, which this is who this really affects. Those would be the people planting hemp if it's legalized. And also, a lot of Democrats trust Comer. He's not really seen as super partisan. He has the support of the Tea Party. He's kind of a coalition builder. And so I think his push to revive the Dormant Hemp Commission, to push this bill seriously in this session, not that it hasn't been pushed seriously before, but, you know, I don't know that anyone of the level of Comer, a seated statewide official, has pushed as hard on hemp as he has. And I think that's the difference. I think the fact that it's Comer doing it and not a state representative or a state senator or a, you know, gubernatorial hopeful actually gives hemp, I guess, some legitimacy this time. But it still has hurdles. I mean, it is by no means going to fly through the General Assembly this session. There's a lot of work to be done in the House. And then also, either they're going to have to ask for a federal waiver from some of the federal drug laws in order to plant it, or, you know, Senator Paul and all these people on the federal delegation who say they support hemp are going to have to work, you know, their peers in Congress and get it, you know, changed on the federal level as well.
One of the other big issues coming up this session, of course, pension reform. And Kentucky has had its S&P downgraded Kentucky again to a negative outlook because of the it's fallen so far behind in funding its pension system.
That's exactly right. I think S&P did this late yesterday. The news came out this morning about the same time as, you know, 50 of the state's business organizations and leaders held a press conference here in Frankfort saying we have to take control of this pension problem immediately. They had the press conference scheduled before S&P made its move, although I'm sure now that, I mean, they referenced the report over and over again. You know, if you're looking to buy the state's bonds or invest in the state, and you look at S&P, it's going to say it's a negative investment. It's not a good thing to invest in. You won't get your return back. You won't even make money. And so, you know, that's pretty bad for the state. It really hurts bonds and ratings and interest rates and stuff like that. So lawmakers, I this is just kind of another thing that are getting lawmakers to say, we really have to deal with this now. They thought they've dealt with it in years before. Turns out they haven't. And so what's likely to happen is the state Senate is going to pass the task force recommendations that we've talked about before, changing to a cash balance plan, hybrid plan, suspending cost of living increases. They're going to pass that probably in the first week, next week when they get back. And then it'll be up to the House to see how quickly they move. But these business leaders are basically saying, we've got downgraded, we need to pass these recommendations as is so that we can basically stop the bleeding, and then in 2014 we need to worry about how to kind of fill in the hole that the pension has created in the state budget. And if they did those two things, the S&P pretty much wrote in their paper that, in their report, that if the state did those two things, they would upgrade it back to a stable rating.
Kentucky Public Radio's Kenny Colston joining us from Frankfort as the Kentucky General Assembly resumes next week. Kenny, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be back with more in a moment. This is Byline on WFPL. Welcome back to Byline on WFPL. I'm Rick Heller.
WFPL comes from Baptist Health.
Mayor Greg Fisher has announced a long list of sustainability goals aimed at reducing Louisville's carbon footprint. Among other things, Mayor Fisher released a draft yesterday of the city's first comprehensive sustainability plan. And joining us now to talk about that is WFPL environment reporter Erica Peterson. Hi, Erica.
Hey, Rick.
Good to have you back again. Well, we mentioned carbon footprint. Why else do we have a plan, sustainability plan?
Well, the sustainability plan is something that's been kind of batted around for a long time, the idea of having one. And Maria Cutter, the city's director of the Office of Sustainability, was hired about a year ago. For one of the reasons is to create this plan and to start working towards it. And what they say is that this plan, they're calling it a triple bottom line approach, which means that it's recognizing the interconnectivity of people, prosperity, and the planet. So what they want to do with this plan is they want to protect the environment by reducing the city's carbon footprint. They want to ensure, you know, the health, wellness, and prosperity of the people who live in Louisville, and they want to create a culture of sustainability.
Now, this all sounds great, but the devil's in the details, right? How do we go about achieving these goals?
Okay, well, it's not a light plan. It's about 40 pages.
Yeah.
And basically, they broke it down into six sections. They talk about the environment, they talk about transportation, they talk about the economy, community, engagement, and energy. And it sets out 19 goals, which Mayor Fisher released on Twitter one at a time yesterday before they released the plan. And those goals, some of them are really ambitious and really specific. One of the goals is to decrease the energy use citywide per capita by 25% by 2025. Also decrease the energy use in city-owned buildings by 30% by that time. They want to increase recycling citywide by 25% in the next 2 years. They also want to achieve 90% residential recycling participation by 2025. And then there are things like increasing access to healthy foods, creating more Mayor's Mile locations for people to exercise outdoors, to incorporate sustainability into the land development code, to replace and reforest the parks, to work on the urban heat island effect, which has been shown to really affect Louisville by planting more trees. So there are 19 goals, and and these are what, I guess, the plan will be working towards over the next, you know, some of the goals. The furthest one out, I guess, is 2025? Yeah, so. Oh, 2042 is the farthest one out.
So what's the early reaction been among those who watch these things?
Well, the reaction has been kind of mixed. The people I spoke with yesterday agree that it's an ambitious plan. One of the issues that was brought up was a lot of these goals are very measurable. You know, if we manage to increase recycling by 25%, if that's the goal, we can determine whether the city actually meets that goal. You know, so that's quantifiable. Some of the goals, like in particular, decreasing impervious surfaces and improving waterway quality. How do we know when that happens? You know, how do we know when water quality is improved? It doesn't include any metrics for, we'll measure this and that. Expanding green infrastructure. If we do one more green infrastructure project, does that mean the goal has been met? So there's some kind of questions about that. There were also some comments from, most notably from Bud Hickson, who's an attorney for the Coalition for the Advancement of Regional Transportation, the group that has fought the Ohio River Bridges Project for the past couple of years, said it seems a little bit disingenuous to release this report that puts a lot of emphasis on transportation and decreasing the greenhouse gases that are emitted from cars and reducing vehicle miles traveled when the city has already, signed on to the Ohio River Bridges Project, which will, put more money towards basically car travel.
Now, we should stress this is a draft plan, which means there's room for more input, right?
Yeah, it is. This is a draft plan, and people have the entire month of February to take a look at it and submit any comments they have. You can go onto our website, WFPL.org, search on sustainability plan. There are a couple of links to do that. You can comment on Twitter, on Facebook. There's also going to be a public meeting on Wednesday, February 20th at 6:30 at the Jefferson Community Technical College Health Sciences Building. And that'll be another opportunity for people to come and tell the mayor and tell Maria Cutter what, any comments might be on this plan.
WFPL's Erica Peterson is our environment reporter. You can find out more about the plan, as she mentioned, at WFPL.org, and also see and hear her reporting as well. Erica, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Rick.
You're listening to Byline on WFPL. Last night, 13 same-sex couples took symbolic wedding vows in Bloomington during a protest against a proposed constitutional amendment that would ban gay marriage in Indiana. Mayor Mark Cruzan led the ceremony. Indiana lawmakers approved a constitutional gay marriage ban in 2011, but it must be approved again, and then they have to pass, or the public has to pass a referendum before it can take effect. Well, joining us to talk about last night's wedding and the effort to write a gay marriage ban into Indiana's constitution is WFIU's Brandon Smith. Hi, Brandon. Thanks for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for having me today.
Well, first of all, Indiana already has a law on the books that bans gay marriage, but
why
do some Indiana lawmakers, and this is a Republican-led initiative, want to write it into the Constitution?
Well, I don't think there have been a ton of great answers about that. It primarily has to do with they believe that they're protecting traditional marriage and that they want to go further than just a state law that can be changed by any legislature at any time in the state, and that making it a constitutional amendment will protect traditional marriage in the long term.
Now, Republicans have a supermajority in both chambers this year, but Senate President Pro Tem David Long and the House Speaker Brian Bosma and others really don't appear particularly eager to address it this session. But it could still be brought up next year.
It can still be brought up next year, which is, it looks like that's the course they'll likely take this time around. Both Speaker Bosma and Senate President Pro Tem David Long spoke yesterday about it. They said they will make a decision whether or not the legislature will hear the marriage amendment this year or not. They'll make that decision likely next week and announce it together. Both of them expressed a desire to wait for the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, to act on this issue. We're expecting that over the summer and into the fall. And then they can come back and, depending on the court's ruling, either take up the amendment next year or not.
Now, parallel to this, it seems that some in the business community have raised concerns about doing this. I think most notably Eli Lilly. They say, we're trying to attract the most talented people we can get to come here and work for us, some of whom are gay. And when they're looking around the country for a place to work, quality of life comes into play. And it would appear the state's pushing them away. So there seems to be maybe an economic component to this, too.
Oh, absolutely. And you mentioned Eli Lilly. Cummins is a big a company in the state who's also been very outspoken opposing the marriage amendment. And part of it is that they're worried about attracting same-sex or gay workers. But part of it is the second line. It's a very simple amendment. It's only two lines long. But the second line, and I'll read it for you, it says that the amendment would provide that a legal status identical or substantially similar to that of marriage for unmarried individuals shall not be valid or recognized. That seems to be what is causing the business community the greatest headache, because they're worried that that could make null any benefits that they choose to extend to same-sex couples, which would not be against the law as currently stated in Indiana, but might be against the law if that amendment is passed into the Constitution.
So there was this wedding last night, and it took place as part of a film festival in Bloomington, right?
Yes, it was part of the film, the GLBTQ film festival, yes.
And it was presided over by the mayor of Bloomington, Mark Cruzan. Has he said why he's gotten involved in this?
It's a symbolic effort. He was a lawmaker himself for, I think, about 16 years. This was symbolic. He wanted to show people that there's a lot of support against this amendment, growing support against this amendment. And so, it was an entirely symbolic act because, obviously, with or without the amendment, it's same-sex marriage is still against the law in Indiana. But he wanted to send a message to lawmakers in Indiana, in Indianapolis, and I'm not sure he did. Senate President Pro Tem David Long was asked about it yesterday, whether he was surprised about the marriage, the mass gay marriage ceremony, and he said no because it's Bloomington. he pretty much dismissed it with a chuckle.
Let me ask you, this is totally something different. I'm not sure if you've been covering this or not, but are you familiar with this story about the couple in Connersville that they've been nursing the injured deer back to health?
Yes, it has been quite the talk of the State House this week.
So let me make sure I got it right. They found an injured deer. They nursed the deer back to health, but they're in some sort of trouble with the Department of Natural Resources, right?
Well, it goes beyond... Just saying they nursed it back to health, I think, is too simple, if only because they then kept the deer for, I think, a couple of years.
Oh.
And they also, they also contacted the DNR to tell them about the situation and make sure it was okay. And the Department of Natural Resources said, no, it's not okay. But they kind of soldiered on anyway. So it's more than simply, they nursed this deer back to health and the DNR came and arrested them. But it appears as if that situation is going to be resolved. And then the DNR will not end up pressing charges, I think, is what's going to end up happening here.
Well, I know some high-level politicians have gotten involved in it, most notably the governor and the Speaker of the House.
That's right. They were both asked about it this week. The Speaker of the House suggested that a pardon was probably the best route, and Governor Pence hadn't made, when he was asked about it Wednesday, he said he was aware of the situation, he was going to be briefed on it, and he'd make a decision. So he was sort of noncommittal at that point.
Brandon Smith with Indiana Public Broadcasting and WFIU Radio in Bloomington, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Byline on WFPL. The Kentucky Department of Community-Based Services, part of the Cabinet for Health and Family Services, has an $86.6 million budget shortfall. Because of this, major cuts are coming to the Child Care Assistance Program, which offers subsidies to low-income working families. And here to tell us about the potential impact of the cuts and other details is WFPL Online Managing Editor Joseph Lord. Joe, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Rick.
Well, why is there a budget shortfall in this agency, and how did it get to be so large?
Well, I talked to Teresa James, who's the commissioner of the department in question here. She says that the department has been offering these programs for a long time, and they had because of budget cuts and the money that hasn't been coming in from the federal government that had come in the past, they'd stacked up some money over the years, and they were that allowed them to pay for these things, and the money just kind of ran out, and now they're trying to they say they've looked at every angle they could to try to keep this going the way it had been going, and they just ran out of options.
Now, I understand you have a piece of tape, I believe, with her talking about this. Let's listen to that, Brad.
I don't have a savings account anymore. I don't have anything to cut. Every cut that was before me was a painful one that had impact on the lives of individuals.
So, therefore, there's going to be some changes to the program coming for that involve those in the program and those who may be in the program in the future.
Right. There are two programs that are going to get these cuts. The first one, the smaller of the programs, is a kinship care program, which gives a little bit of money to families that are caring for children of relatives. The bigger cut, however, is with the child care assistance program. And as you mentioned before, it offers subsidies to low-income families for their daycare, the working families, so they can go to work or school or things like that. And so the effective on April 1st, they're not going to take any new applicants, with a few exceptions, teen parents, things like that. And then effective July 1st, they're going to lower the raise the standards, really. 100 today it is 150% of the federal poverty guidelines. It will go down to 100%, which for some families could be about an $11,000 difference. So it's going to affect a lot of families.
So we're talking thousands and thousands of children could be impacted by this.
Yeah, in the first cut, the one where they won't be accepting new applicants, except for in some exceptions. They're saying about 1,600 families on average per month, and then with the other one, they're talking about 8,700 families on average per month. So,
and I know you talked to Terry Brooks with Kentucky Youth Advocates about the impact of this as well.
Yeah, and it's far ranging. First off, it affects these families first and foremost. It could also have some effects on child care providers. So,
we'll listen to Terry. You have a piece of tape here with Terry.
And we're talking about hardworking, low-income families. We are not talking about folks who simply have, you know, a handout, but we're talking about folks whose family budget is, you know, a big piece of that, or these support.
And you report that this could even result in a rise in so-called underground daycares.
Yeah, I mean, these families that are going to be left out, they're going to have, if they want to keep working, they're going to have some sort of options. And there are some concerns among advocates that people will start looking at people in their community and their neighborhoods who are watching kids but aren't regulated, that aren't inspected by the state as most licensed daycares are, and that could be that there's concern that could be a danger.
The Kentucky General Assembly is in session, or will resume next week. Is there any movement afoot among lawmakers to try to restore some of this funding?
It doesn't look like it. It doesn't seem that there's much hope right now that this situation could be resolved.
You can read more about this story and other reporting by Joseph Lord at our website, WFPL.org. Joe, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rick.
This is Byline on WFPL. There's a big sports championship this weekend in the United States. No, we're not talking about the Super Bowl, but the Cyclocross World Championships. You might not have heard of cyclocross, but it is the fastest-growing bicycle discipline in the U.S. It is grueling. Riders traverse mud, sand, and other obstacles. For the first time in its 60-year history, the championships will be held outside Europe. They are right here in Louisville. And WFPL's Devin Katayama brings us a preview.
The first thing you have to know about cyclocross is the fans are a bit crazy. This was at last year's Louisville Derby City Cup. Hundreds of people, some in costumes, packed onto the course to cheer the riders on. It's not like the Tour de France. It's an off-road course, but they use similar bikes with tough tires and deep treads. Racers carry their bikes up steps. In other parts, they pedal through mud, often in cold, wet conditions.
For people that don't know anything about cyclocross, it's kind of like when everyone drinks a bunch at a college football game when they're tailgating just before they go in.
That's Jeremy Powers. He's the top-ranked U.S. cyclocross racer. Internationally, he's 11th. Last year, Belgian racers took the top 7 spots in the World Championships. That's because the sport has deep roots in Europe.
There were tires that they would use that were like handmade, hand-sewn cotton tires, basically. With like rubber, you know, put on them. You know, even 5 years ago, those were very, very hard to get in the United States.
Cyclocross began as a way for cyclists to stay in shape during winter months. As the sport developed, courses added certain features to make them challenging. This week in Louisville, riders shared the course with workers as they put on the finishing touches. Event director Joan Haskam says the sport is growing quickly, and the international cycling body, the UCI, wants to expand globally.
So they had a vision for what other markets would work, and the U.S. is the fastest growing market for cyclocross in the world.
In the past few years, the number of riders at cyclocross events has tripled to 100,000, according to USA Cycling. But Haskam says U.S. fans haven't shown up yet.
We don't have the spectator base. We don't have the football fan watching our sport here, but we have the participation base. And I think for the sport to grow long term, you need to have both.
In Europe, it's the opposite. Cyclocross racers are celebrities. Sven Ness is one of Belgium's most well-known cyclists. He says he's adjusted to Louisville, but says traveling is a challenge.
At the normal race, I have 5 bikes with me and more wheels.
How many bikes do you need?
Normally, over here, three or four. I have three with me, so I hope it's enough.
Ness says if the sport's popularity does continue abroad, it's something he'll have to get used to. But some things are likely to remain the same, such as loud fans and beer. Jeremy Powers, the top-ranked American, agrees it doesn't matter what country he races in. The fans are always supportive, and there will be the occasional costume. Or not.
I came around a corner at a race in Colorado, and this guy said to me, "Hey, look over here, Powers." And I was like, "Oh, what? Oh, my gosh." This guy is just butt naked in the woods. A dude that I kind of knew was butt naked in the woods.
Powers says even that won't throw his attention, but he can't count on the Belgians budging either.
That was WFPL's Devin Katayama reporting on the Cyclocross World Championships being held this weekend in Louisville. I think Devin plans to attend this weekend. Hopefully he'll be on his best behavior, and you may bump into him out there. Officials announced this morning that the elite men's and women's races scheduled for Sunday have been moved to Saturday. They project the course could be flooded and say all weekend tickets will still be honored on Saturday. For more information, visit our website, WFPL.org. We'll be back with more in a moment. This is Byline on WFPL. Welcome back to Byline on WFPL. I'm Rick Heldet. The Peabody Award-winning radio show The Moth is hosting a grand slam in Louisville tonight at the Baumhard Theater. Storytellers who have qualified through the local Story Slam at Headliners will vie for a spot on The Moth Radio Hour, which airs here on WFPL Saturdays at 3 p.m. WUOL's Daniel Gillum spoke with Jennifer Hickson, senior producer of The Moth, about tonight's event.
Let's talk about the Louisville Storytellers. And what is it that you find unique about Louisville stories or the storytellers? Or maybe it's Kentucky. Maybe it's not just Louisville. Maybe it's more of a regional thing.
I don't know what it is. The South, you guys got something down here. I will just say that The Moth, we have story slams all over the country, and we listen to all these 10 stories per month, and some cities have more than one slam a month. Louisville has, we have podcast 5 stories from your series, and which, you know, other cities got nothing podcast in this last year. We love Louisville stories for some reason. And I would say if I line them all up next to each other, they don't have anything particularly in common. I guess there's a fresh voice. You just have cool people living here. I can't explain why, but we love your stories. Some of it was, there's a story tonight. One of the guys is telling a story about rabbit hunting. So that's not something we do in New York. So that's a very regional story. But the other stories there have universal themes. People are telling things that aren't specific to this area.
And is that what really makes The Moth powerful, is that regardless of who's telling the story, there is a universal emotion or theme?
Yes, I think that's, I mean, what a great story does is bring us into your world, and sometimes it's a weird world, like rabbit hunting, that not weird for, obviously, rabbit hunters, but for someone like me, I've never done that. Or then there's some people who tell a story about heartbreak, which pretty much we all have suffered that, or a breakup, and they're telling something we've all experienced, but they're making it their own, but they're connecting with us somehow, so... Mm-hmm.
As you travel the country and listen to stories, you've probably heard hundreds of stories. Are there regional peculiarities in this country? You know, I mean, you mentioned rabbit hunting in Kentucky. You know, are all New Yorker stories, you know, similar? Or
yelling at cab drivers and stuff? I told you
driver.
I'm walking here. No.
Like in L.A., are there a lot of, you know, actors?
Yes,
you know,
there's a lot of performance-based stories there based on the industry there. In Detroit, we've had some car industry stories, I would say. Yeah, they're all over the country, though. A lot of people come to The Moth through podcasts, but then a great number come through public radio. And so, and public people who listen to public radio are a special, cool kind of sorts of people. And
they
so...
Are.
They, in some ways, there's similarities across the country. But yeah, I don't think that I could really peg a different a region as, wow, their stories are really dark or particularly hilarious. Mm-hmm. Everybody has a mix of everything. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What kind of stories will we hear tonight?
The stories tonight, we're going to, as I said, go rabbit hunting. We're going to leave the country. I think we're going to stop in Africa for a while. We're going to have a broken heart. We'll be in India. Someone traveled to India. I'm looking over the names here of these wonderful people. People sharing stories about their parents and a mystery injury. I mean, it's really going to run the gamut. The theme is fish out of water, but it's sort of any time or place in your life where you felt out of place.
Jennifer Hickson, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And that was Jennifer Hickson, senior producer of The Moth, talking with WUOL's Daniel Gillum. The Grand Slam is tonight, 8 o'clock at Baumhard Theater. You can find information of the events at the events calendar at WFPL.org. And we're now going to turn to our arts segment here on Byline at WFPL. And Erin Keene is here with us. Welcome back, Erin.
Hi, Rick.
You're also involved with The Moth as well, aren't you?
I am co-hosting it with Gabe Bullard tonight, so you'll see me on stage.
Going to be a lot of fun. Well, before we turn to you and your special guest, we have a couple of events we want to talk about this weekend. First of all, Girlfriend has opened at Actors Theater.
Yes, this is a musical that uses Matthew Sweet's landmark power pop album from 1991 as the soundtrack to a really sweet, innocent, but not saccharine, very believable love story between two 18-year-old boys right after high school graduation in the 90s, a small town, Nebraska. You know, they bond over music. They're you know, they fall in love, really. It's lighthearted, but not wimpy. Really just an amazing, beautiful little show.
And you saw it when, last night?
I did. My review is up on our website on WFPL.org. If you want to know if it's any good, in a word, yes. And it's also a lot of fun.
You were telling us up in the newsroom, the response, audience response was tremendous.
You know, I've not seen a crowd in the Pamela Brown that audibly appreciative in a long time, that sincerely swept away with the show, really. So I haven't heard from anybody yet who was like, meh, it was okay. You know, everybody seemed to be really taken with it.
Well, from Girlfriend to Burlesque as Va Va Valentine, I've been waiting all hour to say that, opens this weekend as well.
Yeah, this is an Art Sanctuary production. They do these periodic Va Va Vixen burlesque shows, and they always have a theme. The one going up this month that begins this weekend and then runs through February 16th, it's at Headliners. And it's a vaudeville-style burlesque variety show. So expect lots of musical numbers, singing, dancing, acrobatics, you know, hooping, lots of different costume changes. The costumes are always a little out of this world. And it's hosted by Leah Roberts. So if you see a lot of the smaller companies, theater companies here in town, you've seen her on stage. She's very charming. So I think that that's going to add like a little extra oomph to this show.
All right. Girlfriend and Va Va Valentine. Looking for something to do this weekend. Sounds like a lot of fun. And you have Alan Jones in the studio.
Yes. I'm here with former Louisville Ballet Artistic Director and wonderful choreographer Alan Jones.
Well,
welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome to Byline.
Thank you.
So this weekend, you are choreographing and directing an infrequently staged chamber ballet.
Yes.
And it's called L'Histoire du Soldat, The Soldier's Tale. Forgive my awful French. The Soldier's Tale by Igor Stravinsky.
Yes, yes.
Tell us a little bit about this show.
Well, it's very rarely done, and it is such a fantastic piece. The music is extraordinary, which I've known, you know, for a very long time. And I spoke to Dallas Tidwell, the clarinetist, and Peter McHugh, the violinist, and I said, why isn't it done more often? And they said, because it is so difficult.
From an instrumental point of view.
From an instrumental point of view.
Wow.
It is extraordinarily difficult.
So Stravinsky created this World War I era
yes.
chamber ballet, and it's designed to be performed in the humble spaces.
Yes, he wanted to do something that could be taken on tour, if you wish, to small venues. It had its first performance in Switzerland in 1918, and practically the entire cast was wiped out by that extraordinary epidemic of Spanish flu. If you're
a Downton Abbey fan.
If you're a Downton Abbey fan, yeah.
Do you know what that's about?
It killed thousands and thousands of people. And it wiped out almost all of the performers in The Soldier's Tale. What is different about this is it's not a ballet and it's not just chamber music and it's not a theater piece. It's a combination of all three.
It has a narrator.
It has two narrators.
Two narrators,
yeah,
okay.
Two narrators, three dancers, and seven musicians.
And so the story is a Faust-style story, yes?
It is. It's the story of a soldier who is home on leave. He's only given 10 days. and he meets the devil. And virtually, to encapsulate it, he sells he gives his violin to the devil in exchange for a book. And the book is your dream stock exchange information. And it predicts what is going to happen 4 days before it does.
Wow.
So virtually what he's doing is selling his soul.
Mm.
And then he encounters a princess who has a very strange malady. She doesn't want to eat. She's asleep all the time and she doesn't want to speak. And he plays the violin and rouses her, and she comes back to life, in other words. But the devil finally takes him. She does. She doesn't go to hell. He does.
Ah, yeah. So, you know, the story is like Faust, striking a bargain with the devil in exchange for short-term satisfaction that ends up in, you're putting your immortal soul at risk. There's a long-standing tradition in literature and the arts of these types of storylines.
Most certainly.
Why do you think this is such an appealing storyline to return to?
Well, I think it's interesting, don't you?
Yeah.
Sell your soul to the devil for what? What are you going to get in exchange? He has wealth. And then he finds out he doesn't want it because he has no life anymore. Nobody recognizes him. He walks through his birthplace and as if he's a zombie.
So he might as well already be
dead. He might as well already be dead. Yeah.
But,
he does repent, but it's too late. And the conditions are that he stays in this small country where the princess lives and they marry.
Oh.
But he crosses the border. And in doing that, the devil's got him.
I thought, a happy ending, a sad ending. No, spoiler alerts. Sorry. Yeah. So it's an hour long.
An
hour long. And now you've done something a little different with the character of the soldier in this piece.
Yes. Normally there are three narrators. There's the principal narrator who is telling you the story as you go along. And then the other two are the devil and the soldier.
Mm.
The devil is very often a dancing part, and the soldier is not.
Okay.
But because we have three wonderful dancers from the Louisville Ballet, I thought, well, they should be dancing, not just walking around. So it's great.
So tell us about your dancers.
Well, there's the wonderful, gorgeous Natalia Ashkmina.
Yes.
And her husband, Philip, who is doing the part of the devil.
Mm-hmm.
And Edward Forehand is playing the soldier.
And so the Kentucky Center Chamber Players.
Yes, who are just fantastic.
Who is this group, for those
this
who don't know
group,
about
This is a group, some of them are former players with the Louisville Orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
Peter McHugh, for many years, was the concertmaster. Dallas Tidwell was the first clarinetist. And Jerry Armand, who is still with the orchestra, is the trumpeter, who really plays such virtuosic music. Is absolutely extraordinary. For the violin and the clarinet, to pick three of the musicians and the trumpet, it's extraordinary music. The others are fabulous also, And the percussionist is great. I mean, they're all wonderful. But these three, absolutely, because of the scoring of the piece, stand out as these. I mean, it's unbelievable.
And so the last time this work was performed in Louisville was, it's only been staged twice.
Yes, and I'm sorry to say I didn't see it either time.
Me neither. So I don't even know if I was born yet. So it's been a while.
There was one in the 60s. Yes.
I know.
But Dallas Tidwell, our clarinetist, talked to me about this at least 20 years ago.
Ah.
He said, we'd really like to do The Soldier's Tale. I said, well, so do I. So would I. And so here we are almost 25 years later doing it.
No time like the present. So this is Sunday at the University of Louisville's Comstock Hall.
At 5 o'clock.
At 5 p.m.
Yeah.
on Sunday. Well, real quick, we have just about a minute left, but I know that the Louisville Ballet is in rehearsals now with your staging of Romeo and Juliet.
Yes, it is.
How's that going? Just a little sneak preview.
It's marvelous. Again, The inspiration is the music, and here we have this phenomenal score by Prokofiev. And it's always been very successful here in Louisville since we first did it, I think, 27 years ago. Mm. Also, I've done it in Texas and Florida and 2 years ago in Colorado. And, you know, everybody loves this story.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And then you get this glorious, glorious music. And it's really nice to be working with a totally different cast.
That's right. Yeah. Well, thanks so much for joining us today,
Thank
Alan.
You so much. I appreciate it.
The Soldier's Tale, Sunday at Comstock Hall at U of L, 5 p.m.
Thanks to Alan Jones, and thank you, Aaron Keene, for joining us. That's all the time we have for today's program. For more information about topics discussed on Byline, or to hear the program, visit WFPL.org. Byline is produced by the WFPL News staff, our production team led by Laura Ellis and Brad Yost. I'm Rick Howlett. Have a great weekend.